Good afternoon. I call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 6, 2015. Time is 1:32 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Kawasaki, Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Guttenberg, Edgman, and Munoz. Today we're going to hear overviews from the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. First up will be the Department of Natural Resources overview, Commissioner Mark Myers, Mr. Designee. We'll start out, we've got a fairly thick book. We'll start out if we can, asking questions if we can keep them on point. If it starts looking at time management issues without the department being able to get through their full presentation, we will cut off questions and ask them to be held to the end. So if you have to ask a question, ask it. If not, I would prefer to do it at the end. We have been joined by Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Myers, Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, and I have with me Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles and our budget and what do I call you? Sports Services Division Director Gene Davis. And so I'm going to go through really quickly some of the department's missions, and Deputy Commissioner Fogle is going to go through a few of the missions and measures, the key performance measures, and then we're going to get into the detail of the budget itself. So turn to the first page. DNR has about approximately 1,100 total employees. We're only 2% of the state's budget, GF budget. We manage about 160 million acres of surface and subsurface and submerged lands for the state. We're divided with two deputy commissioners. One deputy commissioner handles basically all things energy, except for energy permitting. And that's Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford, who many of you know. And Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles then handles our other divisions, agriculture, mining, land, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, the State Division of State Parks and Rec, and Department of Forestry and Sports Services. So if you look at the Department of Natural Resources, I think if you want to think of an analogy for us, Department of Natural Resources is the engine room of the state. It's where the majority of the development of natural resources. It's also where the majority of the state revenue comes from. Just kind of a little fun fact is for every dollar a GF DNR has, it directly returns to the state treasury $36 in terms of. So it's a very efficient organization. It's relatively small. You might think of it also as equivalency in the federal side to Department of Interior, with one exception. We have a Department of Fish and Game, and they have a Fish and Wildlife Bureau for Fish and Wildlife, but we have forestry. And most of the forestry in the federal government's in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we're roughly in parity. They obviously have more land, but they have 70,000 employees, for example. So our major missions can be bucketed really into core services that are four big areas: commercial development and use of state lands and natural resources, long-term wealth and employment being a key part. Again, if you look where jobs are generated in the state, where economic income comes from, where the materials that we export and use internally come from, it's significantly from state lands. Another mission, you really sometimes don't think of DNR this way, but we're a public safety organization in a big way, particularly with respect to natural disasters. The biggest area of engagement responsible for the state's version of fighting forest fires. And you'll see that fighting forest fires is a significant part of DNR's budget. And we also then, that same division, manages the forest, the state forest on behalf of the people of Alaska. We do, through the Geologic Survey, the State Geological Survey, we do volcano monitoring in cooperation with the U.S. Geological Survey and also the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But we also do earthquake. We work on the Alaska earthquake system in terms of doing the monitoring and warning for earthquakes. We also do a lot of work with understanding flood risk, landslide risk, and coastal erosion. So we live in a very vibrant state. You know, as a geologist, I can say this is a very risky state to live in many ways because of the natural hazards. Look at the earthquake or a tsunami risk. Go back just 50 years ago to the 64 earthquake. and you'll get a sense of the importance of understanding and mitigating those risks through good science and data. Then we also are the main provider, largely through Division of Mining, Land, and Water, of providing lands for Alaskans to use, whether it be a recreational cabin, whether it be a new subdivision, whether it be land for commercial development. We also have been the leading agency that looks at land selection. So when the state got its entitlement to land, it did a great job, right? A remarkable job of analyzing at Moose Pasture on the North Slope, now called Prudhoe Bay, picking that when it was not geologically well understood that that was the key oil and gas province, where most of the work was over in the Colville Delta area. So just the state has done a wise job of selecting land. It continues to evaluate that land. It's about 5 million more acres in the final selection process to get. But because of the wise selections, the state has the economic development in mines, timber, oil and gas, sand and gravel, and access to infrastructure. And then also we're a data-driven science organization with the State Geological Survey, but all DNR, it coordinates state mapping, satellite imagery, digital elevation modeling, and that data is incredibly important. Alaska is very much undermapped. So again, if you look at our land ownership, it's over a wide distribution of Alaska. As I said before, it's about 160 million acres. We have more coastline, much of it under state ownership in the submerged lands than does any other state in the nation. In fact, we have more than the rest of the nation altogether. When you look at our management responsibilities, one of the things that's really important to put those management responsibilities in perspective in terms of where we're located and what we manage. So when you overlay Alaska from the lower 48, many of you have seen similar illustrations. The red are our offices. The blue is state lands. So we are managing land from the equivalent of Florida to northern Minnesota, the equivalent of Florida to Mexico. And so these are huge areas. So managing these lands remotely is a very challenging thing. It requires a lot of high technology, communications, really smart management, and many regional offices. And of course, managing these lands in Alaska without the infrastructure is not a cheap proposition. So I'll go really quick through our divisions. Division of Agriculture, 40 full-time and part-time positions. Key to promote and encourage the development of agriculture industry in Alaska. They handle quarantine for invasive species. They handle a loan program for ag, and they manage the seed bank for Alaska. They also do key certifications of Alaska products, which are important for export or for commercial consumption of our food resources. Division of Forestry, as I mentioned before, Division of Forestry is key to protect our forests, to do proactive management of fire. Again, you always have a supplemental budget every year, and the better we do on the proactive side, the cheaper that budget is. It protects life, but we also manage those forests for Alaskans. Alaskans use those forests recreationally, but we also use them for wood product delivery, for biofuels, for commercial timber. Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, they're our largest science arm. They do have 52 full-time employees. They do geologic mapping, resource identification, and publication of those information. They also really do a lot of the assessment, as we said before, of geologic hazards and risks. They map those. They provide and work on construction materials. And they are a key driver provider of information used by information services by our industry, by our industrial base, particularly our oil and gas and mining and construction folks use them heavily. And increasingly, communities are using data derived then to create stronger resilient communities in light of the changes in the environment, including coastal erosion. Division of Mining, Land, and Water, they're our workhorse. They manage most of the surface estate for us. They do a lot of the permitting for all projects. They manage water resources for us. Key organization in our, and I think you're very familiar with that if you have constituents out there that are really interested in having that recreational cabin or purchasing land. These are the guys that do the land sales. So they do a lot of things from the individual level all the way up to mega projects with respect to mining or oil and gas development. Division of Oil and Gas, of course, is the organization that professionally manages, does pre-sale evaluation of state lands. It manages the subsurface. It manages the royalty components. and it provides a lot of the downhole surface information to protect correlative rights of all parties that are doing oil and gas development, and obviously it's the major source of revenue for the state that comes out of our royalty share from oil and gas. And also, without oil and gas, you don't get oil tax. Without the division of the state lands, you aren't going to get much in oil taxes as well. So it's taxes are a derivative product of the work done through the division of oil and gas, managing the state's endowment of oil and gas. Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation manages the largest state park system in the country. It manages it very inexpensively, and it uses about seven to eight volunteers for every employee in managing those resources. Increasingly, Parks has a success story with becoming much more self-sufficient, about 35% self-sufficient, going to 44% this year, and hopefully to 50% self-sufficient by, I'll say, creative use of marketing, volunteers, and by increased fees. Division of Support Services, Gene Davies runs the division. That division is our backstop for administrative support, but they also run our IT backbone, and they have the recorder's offices across the state. So a very important division that just doesn't do straight administrative support but provides key services to Alaskans as well. With that, I'll turn it over to, the Commissioner's Office, again, relatively small office, about 1% of our budget. And within that office, an important office to stand out is the North Slope Gas Commercialization. So the folks working at AKLNG from the royalty standpoint and leading much of the effort and coordinating with Department of Revenue, Department of Law, and AGDC on the big gas line project is this group. Two other major organizations that report is the Office of Project Management and Permitting, which reports to Deputy Commissioner Fogles. But strongly identified in the state was a challenge with permitting big projects, the complexity, the number of organizations, the confusion, the different points of view of the various agencies, and creating a very solid public process and transparency of information. This office was created to coordinate on behalf of the state at large. It's been very successful. It's mostly funded by program receipts coming in from people that voluntarily use their services. But it gets rave reviews in the sense of making Alaska projects more easily permitted, making sure that the process is expedient but also efficient. Alaska Mental Health Land Trust Office is embedded in DNR, but they really report to a separate board. They provide the land services that brings in revenue to run mental health programs. So with that brief introduction, I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Fogles, who will talk about performance measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. We were asked to highlight four of our performance measures for the committee here today. The first one here is actually the dollar amount under MOU agreements with project applicants and the Office of Project Management and Permitting. So these are the large major projects that are being permitted in Alaska right now. As you can see, there's a dramatic increase over the years. It just really highlights that there's actually a lot going on in the state. And, you know, we have a lot of resources that are of interest, and so a lot of permitting activity. The next one, I think everyone here.
Thank you. About the OPM fee, can you kind of explain what the larger projects were? And then before there was this office, what did we just do it within the Mining, Land, and Water Division? Can you explain that?
Yeah, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the coordination process actually started in the early 1990s with the Fort Knox mine, and for that particular project, the coordinator was actually located in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And then when the Office of Project Management and Permitting was created by Governor Murkowski, that office had both the Coastal Zone Management Program and the Large Project Coordination function in it. And then we started, that's when OPUMP actually started. The larger projects right now, probably on the mining side, the two biggest projects that we're working on right now in permitting are the Donlin Gold Project and the Chewitna Coal Project, probably the two largest. On the oil and gas side, you know, we just finished permitting the Point Thompson Project. We're coordinating the Greater Moose's Tooth 1 Project, which is very significant. And we're also key coordinating state permitting activity for Shell's OCS activity too. Okay. So the second performance measure is, I think you're all familiar with our efforts to reduce the permitting backlog in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water over the years. This is just the progress report. Basically, we've knocked it down by 56% over the years, in large part due to the efforts of Director Brent Goodrum and his organizational operational efficiency skills, and we also had some budgetary support from the legislature to backfill some positions and new positions, and I'm glad to report that it's been very successful. And next one. This is a bar graph showing the square miles of airborne geophysical data that our Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys has published. We've got some capital monies to do more data gathering, and this is critical. We have an awful lot of state land, and we know very little about it. And so, and in particular, we still have state land to get in our statehood land entitlement, and we need to pick that wisely. So we need more data to get the best land.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. The airborne data is pretty much of a winning proposition. So, I mean, we've been doing this all these years. So is there a correlation between what you've mapped, what's been staked, and what's actually gone into development or production? Does that correlate with those numbers as well in some way?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, yes, it does. I'll give you the sort of a very clear example, and that is the Livengood prospect north of Fairbanks. That really was discovered in large part with the assistance of our airborne geophysical program. And so, when we release this information to the public, you see a tremendous amount of staking activity in the area. And so definitely, I mean, we're trying to focus on areas that have high potential for results. And, yeah, and the activity follows. And I'm not sure. I think I can't really. A lot of the big mining projects that are currently producing in the state probably preceded a lot of our airborne geophysical activity. So I'm not sure that we can say that one's not in production yet.
But. Okay.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Wynn. On the permitting backlog, we've made specific efforts to decrease the backlog of permitting in the last couple of years. What is the current wait time for an average permit before your department in the Mining, Land, and Water Division? And will the proposed budget changes affect your permitting backlog?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, it's kind of a difficult question to answer about average wait time because all of our permits and authorizations are so different. A temporary water use permit we might be able to issue in a month or maybe even less. Something like a lease for a commercial operation may take quite a bit longer to issue, 6 months to maybe even a year or more, depending on the complexity of it. So it's a very wide spectrum, but I think we can say that wait times have gone down with our efforts. Mm-hmm. In addition to addressing the backlog, we're also getting more incoming. So there's a lot more activity going on, but we've done a lot of work to decrease wait times. In our budget reductions that are in the governor's budget, when we went through those reductions, we prioritized. We wanted to save the functions intact that produced an economy for the state. That was sort of priority one. Priority two was public safety. And so we really tried hard in our proposed reductions to keep the permitting core intact.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
President Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Fogles, I understand that the work, the airborne geophysical work, the mining, land, and water permit backlog, these are efforts that support future development. Is that correct?
Correct.
So these are kind of launched. These are doing their work. So if there were to be any reduction in these expenditures, that would not diminish the value of those investments going forward. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, Well, I think in part yes, in part no. I mean, we have built up a staff that are experts at doing this, and that's sort of key to keeping it moving. But in addition, and I probably should have mentioned it a little bit earlier, but we are developing an electronic permitting system, and we have developed it. We have now our land use permits and our water rights permits that are two of our key big volume permits. Those are now automated through our process. Thanks to capital appropriations, we have built that, and we continue to build it even further. And so that, there is some money in the capital request to keep that going. If that were to stop at this point, we still have a system for those permits.
But like the airborne geophysical work, that data is out there. That's available for use far into the future by anybody who wants it.
Right. Correct. Representative Sadler.
Representative Pruitt, did you have a question? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ed, I should know this answer, but for mines and then for other development projects, is the permitting process all program receipts funded so that we don't lose money on, let's say, the Chuitna mine if it never goes ahead?
Yes, Representative Guerra, through the chair. For the major projects, yes. They will typically sign up with the OPUMP model, and they reimburse essentially 100% of state permitting costs. Now, the smaller projects or small mom-and-pop projects typically don't, and those, we absorb those through our regular budget.
Thank you.
Kawasaki.
Thank you. On this slide in FY12, there's a pretty significant drop, and I know there's been some changes to some of the permitting or permits that are now required. I know the previous administration was working to sort of find efficiencies or streamline the permitting process. I think a better metric would be to find out what percent of permits are backlogged. So the total number of permits versus the permits that are waiting, along with the time measure, like how long they've been in process, I think is better. It's better to know, because I can't tell from that whether we're more efficient or whether there's just less permits that are required.
So Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I mean, those are good points. We actually have those metrics, and Director Goodrum does he can present in much more detail all the different case types and how they've dropped relative to each other.
Okay.
And you have to keep in mind that the Division of Mining, Land and Water has a tremendous number of authorizations, and they make up that backlog. I think they're probably over 30 different types. So, and even with those, there's subtypes. So it gets kind of complicated, but yeah, if the committee wants, we can dig into those numbers quite a bit more.
Or is it as simple as in 2011, you had 2,659 backlogs, and now you've got, in 14, you've got 1,168, so you've got 60% less. So you got 60% less.
But it...
Okay, and then we have one more performance measure, and that's our state park fees. These are kind of broken out by category, but you can see they're gradually going up, and that's a good sign. And as the commissioner mentioned, up until now, the fees have covered about 34% of our parks operating budget, and we just recently instituted fee increases, which will get us to about 44%. We believe in a couple of years we can raise them even further and maybe get close to 50% from fees. And again, with other innovative projects that we're working on, we aim to, in the future, really reduce the reliance on general funds for the state park system. That's our long-term goal here, maybe not that long-term either. So those are the four performance measures, and I can turn it over to Gene Davis now to get into the number crunching.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Gene Davis. I am the director of the Support Services Division for the Department of Natural Resources, and we have a series of slides that will walk you through our FY16 governor's amended budget, pretty much from that 30,000-foot level that we typically do at the Full House Finance Committee. We started our first subcommittee meeting with Representative Pruitt's group last night, and we anticipate digging into a lot more of the detailed items and divisions at that process. So based on our FY16 budget, DNR will employ about 1,060 Alaskans in full-time and seasonal positions in 29 locations around the state. Our biggest offices are in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Palmer. We included a small chart here which shows you what our position counts have looked like since FY12, so the five-year period through the governor's budget request shows this is fairly stable. Small changes from year to year, and we do see a bigger reduction in the FY16 proposed budget. That is actually, there will be 48 positions that will be reduced in our proposed budget. We have one new position that's proposed for that net of 47. Of those 48 positions, at this point, 34 of them are filled. We will be working with our employees, with our divisions, with the Division of Personnel, and the labor contracts on any kind of layoff process, obviously, after we see what the final budget is that we're implementing. But we do anticipate a fair number of layoffs based on what we have now.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we know where they're coming, what divisions they're coming out of?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, we do. We have released that detail in the budget that was released by the governor yesterday. We have provided that to the subcommittee, and we can provide a single page for you later if you'd like to see that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Send information through the chair.
Yes, thank you. The next slide I'd just like to talk about is a growth slide. This is one that is produced by the Legislative Finance Division. What this shows for Department of Natural Resources from the FY07 management plan through the FY16 governor's amended is, as shows on the left side, an average annual growth rate for us of 3.2%, which is on the low end of all departments. You can see a relatively stable 7 and 8, a bit of a jump in 9. In that time frame, we had some increases related to oil and gas increased workload and to the AGEA project. We then are fairly stable and then creep up again in FY12, where we had the influx of money provided by the legislature to help with a lot of the permitting backlog. So we saw a lot of that increase there, and that relates back to the slide on the performance measures.
Zem Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the growth rate, if I heard you right, is directly related to things happening, right? Not just growth rate because government grows, but because you're dealing with projects and you're dealing with trying to reduce backlogs. Would that be an assumption I can make?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is certainly a piece of a large piece of it is the increase in the volume of resource development activities going on. You do see part of the growth rate. This is a general fund only chart, and a portion of that growth rate is related to labor contracts, okay. Salary adjustments that go with that. But that is to support the people that are doing that work. And we will be doing a more detailed 10-year look back in next Tuesday's subcommittee meeting with Representative Pruitt.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it costs each resident $337,456 for your department. That seems like a lot.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that does seem like a lot, and we will go back and look at that comment and see if we can get that cleared up.
I appreciate that because I don't want to be taxed at that level.
You didn't do this chart.
Move that comma over to the left twice.
Moving on to the next slide, we did take the same chart that we had from legislative finance, and again, general fund only, and wanted to show what Department of Natural Resources budget looks like without the growth related to the AKLNG project. In FY15, this current year, we had an increase of $8.9 million to support AKLNG with the fiscal note for Senate Bill 138 that passed. And in our FY16 budget, we're asking to carry that forward and ask for an additional $4.2 million for that project. So if we were to take $13.2 million out of our 16 budget and 8.9 out of our 15 budget, this is the reflection of what the rest of the core services of DNR are. And that would show an average annual growth rate there of the 1.8%. And it shows that we are the blue line across would be 1.54% of the state's general fund. Looking again, there's two more slides that are prepared by Legislative Finance. We added a little the little call-outs there. You can see that this is general fund only. It shows by our appropriation unit at the bottom. And on our FY fiscal year 7 through 16 management plan and our governor's budget, the general fund only on a graph. The top line, you can see the increase there, is largely due to our increased efforts in permitting. The dark blue line, the larger increase, the uptick there, you can see is due primarily to the AKLNG project. And the one that has the sort of half-triangular increase around FY09 was the AGEA project. Money came into our budget and went back out with the AGEA. The last growth analysis slide prepared by Legislative Finance shows what the picture looks like with all funds. These look primarily the same with the same call-outs with the exception of the fire suppression budget, which does show an increase there in between 12 and 13. And that is $8.5 million federal authority that we added to the budget. We continued to utilize more federal authority year after year, and we just trued it up and made it a little closer to the average annual federal there.
Question. Representative Guttenberg.
Sure. The fire suppression usually correlates with fire activity in the summer. Has it been the jump in 13? Has it been consistent? I mean, have we seen? I mean, that's what we're seeing, consistent fire activity.
Representative, to the chair, we have certainly. I can't say on a year-to-year basis, on a 10-year average, very dominant, significant increase in the amount of acres burned. It's dramatic. And that's because each year is drying, and lightning strikes some months earlier, and many more lightning strikes. So naturally induced fires are increased dramatically. We can get you the statistics, but it's I don't think science will. It is very impressive. And then the other part is with the invasive species. We've seen a lot of people killed and minor kill in our species. So we have a lot more standing dead forests. So fuels and dryness overall.
Thank you.
On that point, Commissioner, has the department been doing more controlled burns so that we don't have to go back and do fire suppression?
Mr. Chairman, definitely fuels treatment will help. We know that it's expensive, but it definitely helps. And so, strategic, we don't fight all fires. We fight fires that affect structures and communities, like the Bunny River fire. So, clearly, in those areas, I think preventive measures and fuel, decreasing fuel loads, including back burns and timber harvest make a lot of sense.
You've had considerable expansion of timber harvest where you've had infestation of beetles?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we certainly have. Between the spruce bark beetle kills on the Keno example, and they're historical, but they were very dramatic. They put us through that cycle, but then we have lots of other kills. Lots of other invasives. We're getting a warmer spring that's launching invasives earlier. And so we're seeing less than species like white spruce aren't getting soil moisture because the snow's melting earlier. So they're stressed. And then the invasives are coming in and attacking. So we're seeing a lot more of it.
So all the Kenai now is to open for timber harvest to harvest all the spruce beetle kills that are leaving all the dead trees out there. So those are open for harvest for private industry to go get.
Representative Newman, I think a lot of the beetle kill on the Kenai is probably within the Chugach National Forest and the wildlife refuge, so it's not state land. So I think we've done our best to try and do timber sales to kind of thin out the beetle kill on state land. And we are doing additional sales down on the Kenai, but I think a lot of the beetle kill down there is on federal property.
That because that's what the commissioner brought up. So yeah. Let's just say we're on state lands where we have issues like that. Those areas are pretty much all open for the timber industry to go in there and harvest those.
We are definitely offering sales in those areas. I think a really good example is probably around the Toke area, where we've done a lot of activity to clear out the fire load around Toke. A lot of clearing, so that any new fires around the Toke area are going to be a lot less intense. Plus, it's given the industry there a lot of biomass for a lot of the biomass projects up there, such as the Toke School. That's got an almost endless supply of wood from the Toke area that's sort of coming from fire clearing.
I don't think those sales been very successful.
I believe so, yeah. Although I should take that back. I think we just had a 25-year sale we put out on the market last year that we didn't have any bidders for. So I think we see sometimes they are, sometimes they're not.
President Sadler.
A brief question. I'm going to look for a silver lining. Is there any possibility that the large burns in the past, I know you don't fight every fire, does this mean that an area that has burned is not likely to cause another forest fire, wildland fire in the next 10, 15, 20 years? Is there a limit to it?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. Yeah, I mean, once a fire burns through, then you clear out the fuel, and so you're going to have a less likelihood of a fire for a certain period of time. I think that kind of depends on the type of forest and the ecosystem. But, yeah, you're definitely going to lower the fire danger there.
Thanks.
Sadler, through the chair, it also depends on the severity of fire and how much is consumed during the fire.
That's in the Big Lake fire. It's not a higher fire hazard right now because you got all these dead trees around there, and the ability to fight it is very difficult because they're all like pixie sticks just all over the place. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to a place where you mentioned, and that was the Toke School and the success they're having down there with all the projects associated with their heaters and the biomass. So is there any effort to coordinate? I mean, when you have a fire or need to do clearing in advance, is there any coordinated effort to make those resources available to somebody or let somebody know that if you're interested in a biomass project like exactly what Toke has, that this is available, that this will be happening, that you need to get involved in that?
Yeah, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, absolutely. I mean, I think the Toke school situation is a perfect example where we saw a huge fire load there, and we worked with the school, and sort of that all happened because of that exact information. And so my staff are out there. They're pretty proactive in finding out where the demand is. If they see the demand, if people come to them and say, hey, we've got a project, we'll work with the private sector or with schools or whatever to try and kind of sync that up.
Okay. You got 10 pages to go and 20 minutes to get there, so we'll have to hold questions.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Again, for the record, Jean Davis. I would like to just give you a quick statistic. We have been looking at the 10-year average of fire suppression general fund costs in preparing for our Division of Forestry overview. And the 10-year average for unrestricted general fund has been $30.8 million. But it is over the 10 years, we've had a 1 year that was a high of $66 million and one that was a low of $7.8 million. So you can see over a 10-year period, you have significantly different fire seasons from year to year. This picture just depicts our operating budget by division or by our major divisions or by our major offices. It shows that our FY16 governor's budget request is $175.1 million compared to FY15 management plan of $178.3 million. And the thing to point out here again is the Division of Forestry that looks like it is has the largest piece of the pie. 22% of our budget is actually fire suppression preparedness and the base amount for fire activity. This gives you a view of what our operating budget looks by the fund types. Unrestricted general fund is about half, 50%, 49% of our budget. We have federal funds at 12.4%, other funds at 23%, and designated general funds at 15.6%. I put little call-outs there so it's really clear so that you can see what the funding sources are that play into what is categorized as other funds. For us, that's reimbursable services agreements, the interagency receipts from other state agencies. The mental health land trust receipts are categorized as other. Industry reimbursements, this is primarily what we have in our state pipeline coordinator's office and in our Office of Project Management and Permitting, and they are categorized as other. And then we have permanent fund receipts, which are in our Division of Mining, Land and Water and Division of Oil and Gas. The designated general funds are the fees from parks, fees from our recorder's offices, and fees from our land and water use permits, land disposal income fund, timber receipts, ag revolving loan fund, and vehicle rental tax. And in looking at what's happened in the last 10 years, I looked back at FY06, and this layout, this percentage, is almost exactly the same. So while we have grown $44 million overall from FY06, we have stayed in the pretty much the same percentage of what is funding our budget. And of that $44 million, $29 million of it is the salary union labor contract. One more picture of the overall operating budget. This is by core service. This represents 48% of our budget goes to fostering responsible development. And you can see then that about 24% of our budget is in that mitigate the natural hazard threats. This is our fire preparedness, the earthquakes, volcanoes, the geologic hazards, coastal erosion that Commissioner Myers discussed. And this is the scary slide that I've had here the last couple of years. What I like to do is use this slide to just start making the explain to you how we build the budget. So the governor's office builds the budget using the FY15 management plan as the base. So we've outlined in the upper left quadrant our core services. We've divided them out by the four funding types: unrestricted general fund, designated, other, and federal. And that's where you see the total for the management plan. If you move across to the right side, you'll see what's labeled an adjusted base. Legislative finance takes things that are in the governor's request and transactions that are in the governor's request and allocates them into the adjusted base scenario, for lack of a better word. And this includes one-time appropriations, one-time items, and salary, the union negotiated salary contract costs. And they become then your FY16 adjusted base, which I then drop down and just duplicate on the bottom left quadrant and show you the difference between that adjusted base, which is your comparison point where you're starting to compare, and the FY16 governor amended budget. So if you look at the change column on the far right, at the top, the change between management plan and the legislative finance calculated adjusted base is a $12.6 million reduction. And if you look at the difference between adjusted base on the bottom to the governor's amended, it's a $9.4 million increase in our budget. I'm going to spend the next slide walking you through something that will make it a little easier to look at and see what those actual transactions are. I think this is an even easier way to look at the budget. If you start at the top, it's our FY15 management plan. You can see the total on the top line is $178.3 million, and we have 1,107 positions. The legislative finance actions are outlined in that kind of light blue, light gray at the top. And that is where they add in what the FY16 cost of our union contractual salary increases are. But they also reverse the one-time items. So the AKLNG for us, the $8.9 million that we talked about earlier, was appropriated to DNR as a one-time item on the fiscal note. So it is backed out of our budget in the adjusted base. We also, every year, the Mental Health Trust is essentially approaches their budget as from zero-based budgeting, Department of Revenue, and our office in DNR. And that $4 million was backed out. And then we had a couple of other one-time items that are backed out. So that leaves you with the adjusted base, which is the starting point for comparing what the governor is doing. The next kind of the light green is the governor's amended budget increments. That's where you see the 8.9 for AKLNG. That's coming back into our budget. And then below that, a $4.2 million increment that we're requesting. And then and those are the only unrestricted general fund items that you will see increasing in our budget. We then add back in the Mental Health Trust money and a small increment for them. And we had some spending authorization in our pipeline and gas line projects in the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. So small increase of other funding there. The next line is the FY16 governor amended budget decrements. This is in kind of the pink or the red area. This is budget reductions that have been spread across all of our divisions. $8.6 million in total, $5.9 million a general fund, and that's where you see the 48 positions that I referenced at the beginning of my presentation. As Representative Wilson asked, I will send a one-pager that has that to Representative Newman's office for distribution. So what we wanted to do and what your House Finance staff asks us to do is to be able to compare our governor's budget to both the FY16 adjusted base, which is the legislative finance starting point, and to the management plan, which is the governor's starting point. So that's what those first two lines and under the comparison in the blue show you. If you look at the total column, this our budget compared to the adjusted base would be a 5.7% increase, and that is largely because of the AKLNG and the mental health money being added back in. If you look at the comparison to the management plan, we're a 1.8% decrease, and that is or a 2.5% decrease in the unrestricted general fund, and that would have been matching the slides that the OMB director Pat Pitney presented here when she originally gave you the graph of what all of the agencies were going to look like, and DNR showed a 2.5% decrease, and that was from management plan. And then we just wanted to throw one more into the bottom there, and that's what our comparison would be if we did not have AKLNG as the addition to our core service within DNR. And that would show us with an overall 2.3% reduction in the budget, all funding sources, but a 7.6% reduction in unrestricted general fund.
I like that chart.
Thank you. We just take a look at the next slide is a department comparison. This is actually based on the FY15 management plan. It is unrestricted general fund only. We laid out all of the departments across unrestricted and called out. You can see where DNR there is in FY15, 2% of the budget. Just lets you see on a single sheet where the unrestricted general fund dollars are going. In FY16, when we are doing this graph again, we're looking at we've decreased down to the 1.75% of the state's budget. So we've hit kind of the high points of the expenditure side of our budget. We'd like to take a look at a graph that we do or a chart that we're doing here that is revenue. Average annual revenue from FY06 to FY14, and the bottom line there is DNR generates an average of $2.6 billion in revenue annually. We categorized it. The large blue is what just goes into the unrestricted general fund. again, on average over that FY 6 to 14 year period based on actuals. What goes into the permanent fund in the orange, the constitutional budget reserve, and then a small slice to other funds, and that includes school fund, ARLF interest, excess program receipts that we collect in either the recorder's office or through state pipeline coordinator lease fees, et cetera. The little blue circle up on the right side shows what our average annual general fund budget has been over that same time period, $72.8 million. This is where Commissioner Myers talked about for every dollar that we've invested in DNR, we are returning $36 into one piece of this pie or another. I think it is important to note in the revenue picture and the revenue stream that, over the next couple of years, this number is going to go down to some level. If we looked at FY14 compared just by itself compared to this 9-year average, and 14 was down about 2.7%. And if you look at compared to from 13 to 14, 14 had dropped by about 10%. So we are seeing that on our side of revenue collection as well. But I think it is good to get that broader picture for DNR.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to put this slide in here just to show you the two major sources of revenue, oil and gas royalties and oil and gas taxes. Because our royalties are based on a percentage of the production, they are much less volatile than a net profit share oil tax system. So if you want to think about where your income's coming from, even though obviously when the price of oil goes down, your royalty value goes down, it goes down proportionally a lot less than does your tax under a net profit share system. So consider it part of your base. Maintaining that royalty share and effectively managing it is really the base of your budget. It's your less risky part of your oil and gas investment, if you'd want to say that. So I just want to put it in contrast. You can see when prices are really high on a net profit share system, you make a lot of money. But when prices are low, we can see the effect. But the royalty does some to buffer that. So royalty management is an extremely important part. DNR's management of the resources and commodities on another parts too are extremely important to the economy. But I just wanted to point out there that, if you look historically, the royalties are not that volatile, even with price change, and at least not as volatile as a net profit share tax system. So when you spread your aids across the basket, the royalty part is really important. And of course, without the royalty part, not the production, you don't have taxes. So again, this really forms the basis of the current economy. I just want you to see this on the slide, because as bad as the price drop is in FY16, you can see the effects on royalty are significant, but we still have a very strong, stable base underneath us there. I would like to go back just to make one other comment, President Wilson's observation of the cost per resident. It should have been around $37, not $336,000. So we're not too much of a burden on Alaskans today.
My apologies.
Commissioner, we'll just take that other out of your admin director's salary, right?
I have the best admin director, I think, in state government, so I'd have to hire her back at higher pay.
I've heard that from every department in here. Thank you. I'm sure that we all feel very well about our staff that we have statewide. President Thompson, Sadler.
Thank you. Go back to slide 24. I had one little question in the green section, other fund. Actually, Gene, permanent fund receipts are coming into the department by what vector?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. You'll test my memory cells, but I don't remember how many years ago. But we did, the legislature did take a look at our budget in both oil and gas and mining, land, and water. And because those are the areas where we are generating a portion of the leases and the royalties and the mining goes to the permanent fund, they chose to fund a small portion of each of those operating budgets from permanent fund earnings.
Far be it from us to question the wisdom of previous legislatures, so thank you.
So just while we're on this page, you mentioned the UGF and how comparison for the last 10 years or so, it stayed the same. Is that for designated general funds, all federal funds, is that across the board?
Representative Newman, it is pretty much across the board. Just so I can just give you the 06 numbers really quick. So 06 for our undesignated general fund was 50%. For designated general fund was 15%. Our other funds were 22%, and our federals were 13%. So we're just slightly lower in Fed, slightly more in other.
About the same.
Very much the same, all the way across the board.
Well, I'm glad that those increases in monies that you got for electronic upgrades have been maybe they're showing why. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions on the fire suppression. So we had a big fire up in the Fairbanks area that was due to some things in the military. If there's an agreement for, let's say, the military to pay back some of the, you know, state assets, does that go back to help offset so we understand on the fire, or does it just go into the general fund?
I believe it goes right back into the general funds, yes. Representative Wilson through the chair, right?
Yes, Representative Wilson through the chair. It is, we would call it a prior year recovery and just deposit it to the general fund.
But there would be no, there would be no way for us to be able to understand how much the state really paid on fire suppression for that year on any offsets that may have come from any entity. When you're showing us in these figures, that's our total fire suppression. It doesn't reflect whatsoever any paybacks that we may have gotten from other entities.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct, although I think that we could probably do some research and find when we have been able to do prior year recovery and give you what that was on a 10-year basis. That might take us a little bit longer, but
I'm just curious. I don't want to put you in a lot of extra work. And the other question I have, Mr. Chair, is on air quality. Is that taken into when a fire is going? I know you take in houses, people, and that kind of effect. But now with Fairbanks and air quality, does that come into the matrix?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I mean, I'd have to probably get back to you on that. I think we have our fire plan that tells us where we need to focus our resources, and it's really based on, on the property values and public safety issues. And I'm not sure that we do take air quality into our prioritizing how we fight fires, but I'll have to check with our state forester and get back to you on that.
Well, I appreciate that because public safety, public health has to do with PM 2.5. At least that's what they keep telling us in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 30, Commissioner, just for FY15 and FY16, we've received estimates that the production tax we're going to receive after credits and deductions is going to be negative for those years. Is that because this was based on the November 2014 price forecast, and the more recent numbers we get are based on more current price forecasts?
President Garrett, through the chair, understanding from Commissioner Hoffbeck was there's a significant amount of new credits that weren't accounted for when we did 14. Going back, you said a higher level of credits. I also suspect the $8 per barrel, I don't know, but I suspect $8 per barrel credit that paid them below $8 a barrel had a significant effect. Maybe not. I'm not sure if I'm adjusting for either of those. But you'd have to ask Commissioner Hoffbeck. I'm not sure.
Okay. And through the chair. If the Shell development goes forward, we're going to hope for revenue from that project. But right now, the way federal law is written, we don't get our production taxes 3 miles out offshore, and so we have to rely on getting a share of the federal royalty. Is there going to be litigation, or has there been litigation, to enforce the statehood compact's 90-10 split promise of offshore oil?
Representative Garrett, to the chair, to my knowledge, not. To my knowledge, it's been a priority of administrations. Many administrations to get federal revenue sharing in the offshore. No one, and in other states they enjoy that right, but in Alaska is excluded from that. And so, but I don't know that under the OCS Act that we are entitled to it. That's a legal question that the state would have to take up.
It would be a better question for our Attorney General.
Yes. I will say there is another source of potential benefit from OCS, and that is, of course, the oil flows through facilities in the state and the re-property taxes, jobs, and extended field life for the Alaska oil fields that are on state lands.
Sure.
So there's certainly economic benefit, but not to the same degree as obviously on state lands.
With that, we're going to wrap up our overview of the Department of Natural Resources. We'll take a brief at ease to allow the Military and Veterans Affairs. Bring the Department of Military Veterans Affairs up. This is the House Finance. We'll back in order. Department of Military and Veterans Affairs overview for the FY16 budgets. Brigadier General Mike Bridges.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Short term.
Very short timer, but still mission to accomplish. Brigadier General Leon M. Mike Bridges. Immediate Acting Adjutant General, past Acting Adjutant General and Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, here on behalf of the still coming on board new Commissioner and Adjutant General Lori Hummel. And I've brought with me our new Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Bob Dole, and are still working with us as Deputy Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management, Mr. Mike O'Hare.
Sir.
Okay, and this is the first time I've been in this setting, and each one's a little bit different, so if you'll bear with me. I think I'm supposed to go through a few slides, do a little bit of a stop for a moment, and then go to questions and answers. Am I kind of on track for that? All right. Mission of the Alaska National Guard and the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, slide number 2. Provide military forces to accomplish military missions in the state or around the world, provide homeland security and defense, emergency preparedness, response and recovery, veteran services, and youth military-style training and education via the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Slide three, our core services. Sorry. Thank you. Got to get my slide meister going here. Our core services, slide three, defend and protect Alaska and the United States, disaster preparedness, response and recovery, youth intervention, and outreach to veterans and military families. And this is, again, the pie chart works out pretty good this time, and the numbers are pretty easily distinguishable with our core service areas, defend and protect, disaster preparedness, youth intervention, and outreach. The permanent full-time positions, the bottom bullet on the right-hand side of each category, respectively. And you'll notice the one of the areas that we have a big bang for the buck is Veterans Affairs, Veterans Support. We have four permanent full-time positions, and we know that there are over 77,000 veterans in Alaska, many of which have still not, for various reasons, mostly of their own choosing, chosen not to yet register with the Veterans Affairs federal side. Our mission and that team's mission is to get every one of those veterans hooked up with their federal VA benefits if they have them due from their military service.
On that point, General, the ability for veterans to go use some of the federal hospitals, is that gone through yet now?
There's been great strides across the country, but Alaska in particular, sir, with outreach in coordination with our Alaska Native healthcare system and corporate care providers around the state, especially for those off the road network. The federal programs are now linked for reimbursement or direct cost benefit to the Alaska Native Tribal Healthcare Trust programs, as well as ongoing expansion efforts for transportation to necessary care facilities for our veterans who may be short on funds, even on the road network. We were successful this year for a three-year forward grant, $750,000 at $250,000 per year, to pay for what they call very rural veterans ground transportation to VA care or facilities, and that includes in Alaska the Alaska highway, the ferries, to get them off from the waterways. Now, this is different from the previous work. We had success getting aerial transportation for those that are off the road network to get to that care as well.
Can they get access to some of the rural health centers yet?
That's exactly what the previous work had already accomplished. So instead of having to fly them into Anchorage from Bethel, for example, or a village in that region, YKHC is able to provide that care now, and the VA pays for the process.
I just know that I speak for every one of us when we talk to our veterans. Their biggest issue is health care.
Yes, sir.
And being able to get to facilities when we're driving right past federally funded facilities already at our brand-new hospital in Wasilla.
Yes, sir.
It provides much better care.
We have a graphic, I think it's in this slide set, and if not, we can provide it to the committee after, that shows where that has transitioned over the last couple of years and where it's going over the next couple of years.
Provide some information to this committee. We'll get it distributed, not just to this, but to other legislators, or maybe you can have your staff to do that so that we can get it out into our communities to show our veterans where locally they can start receiving better health care because of these new changes.
We can absolutely do that, Mr. Chairman. Again, we addressed it last night in a subcommittee, and I'm not sure if it's that graphic's in the slide set, but it has the communities and those locations.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And can you also give us how many doctors there are in each one of the facilities?
I don't have that kind of information for the federal VA care, ma'am, through the chair.
So if we don't have any doctors in the VA hospital, the VA part in Fairbanks, we have to go to the federal government to see for their health care? I'm just trying to find out whether the state keeps track on how many doctors are available for veterans, like when you go on post in Fairbanks, because my understanding is they lost one.
That's not something specifically that our four-person shop tracks. That's federal VA tracking mechanism for the providers. They're the ones who pay those doctors. I can ask Mr. Bowen, our Veterans Affairs Administrator, if we have that, and if not, we can pursue that information to provide.
Well, I'd appreciate that, because it's my understanding in Fairbanks now there are no doctors for our veterans. They go to physician assistants instead of physicians. And so I just want to make sure if we're directing our veterans to certain services, we know what services they should expect to have. Thank you.
Got it. We can check through our Veterans Affairs Administrator and find out what's actually stationed at each. I know we have specific information on the Mat-Su Valley because they've been having some hiring issues with providers there.
Appreciate it.
Okay, back to the pie chart.
Yes, sir.
If there's no other questions on this slide, we'll go ahead to slide five. This is our primary organizational chart of our department and the divisions within, as well as the standalone in the blue box, Alaska Aerospace Corporation. We'll discuss that a little bit later, and we have the vice president who will be dialed in and talked about that a little bit more specifically later in the presentation. The red box is the federal Title 10 officer who works for the chief of the National Guard Bureau as the protector and oversight office proponent for the federal government's property, funds, and equipment that are used by the Title 32 Alaska National Guard forces. So there's a representative of the federal government that's here as an advisor to the Adjutant General and on behalf of the federal Department of Defense to make sure that we're using our federal properties, funds, resources correctly. The new commissioner, as you know, is Lori Hummel, U.S. Army retired. She is still re-enlisting, kind of going through an interesting process, so that's why she's not unable to be here in person today. Our new deputy commissioner is, as I mentioned, Mr. Bob Dole, retired Air National Guard colonel and former Army soldier and officer, so he's military experienced, and we look forward to his participation and leadership in our department going forward. And then we have the primary components of the Army National Guard, the Air National Guard, our Homeland Security Emergency Management Division, the Alaska Military Youth Academy, which was a program funded and established by Congress about 20 years ago to take care of the national security threat of our young people falling off the rails and becoming drains on society versus productive and able to potentially serve in the military in time of need. And then we have our Veterans Affairs Office, which is, as I mentioned, just a four-person staff, and then it's supported by the Veterans Service Officers around the states from VFW, American Legion, and so forth. Those are the direct link to the veterans around the state to get the paperwork and the administrative process to link them with their federal VA benefits. Total force, approximately 4,000 between the Army and the Air National Guard, and a bit over 300 civilian employees in our department. Slide, please. Slide six. This is a little description of your Alaska Air National Guard. Two wings, one north of the Alaska Range, the 168th Tanker Wing, which is the in-flight aerial refueling tankers. They also have a unit at Clear Air Force Station, which is early warning watch unit. They look for incoming things that we don't want to come into America in outer space. The big wing, the 176th Wing, which is based at JVAIR, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, is the most complex and operational wing in the Air National Guard across the country. And it's got a combination of the heavy lift, which is the C-17 cargo jets, the C-130 aircraft, which is the small cargo airlift squadron, the Rescue Coordination Center for the state of Alaska. We have the combat search and rescue squadrons. Those are the ones who, in their combat role, pick up downed pilots in combat zones. Here in Alaska, they save Alaskans' lives on a weekly basis minimum when they get in trouble around our great state. And then we have the Air Defense Squadron, which is the NORAD mission, and that's run by Air Alaska Air National Guard to watch for interspace invasion by fixed-wing aircrafts from other nations that we don't want necessarily over U.S. sovereign air and ground space. Slide, please. The Alaska Army National Guard, approximately 1,900 members. That's the state headquarters, the Joint Forces headquarters, which is quite small. We have a battlefield surveillance brigade, which the Army has decided it doesn't need any of them anymore, so ours is one of nine that will be deactivating later this year. And we're working on the replacement force structure from that, from the Army, as the Army downsizes. And then our 38th Troop Command, which is a brigade equivalent administrative headquarters for our other units, what we call IBUs or itty-bitty units, our aviation battalion, and our military police battalion. So spread across the state from Barrow clear down to Ketchikan and from Bethel into the center of the state. We also have the 49th Missile Defense Battalion, which is ground-based missile defense based at Fort Greely, 24/7, 365 days a year, operational national strategic mission. That's 210 Alaska Army National Guard members on full-time status in support of the ICBM threat from rogue nations such as Iran and North Korea. We have a small full-time unit, which is also 24/7, 365, which is our civil support team, and that is primarily for weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, radiological hazards of accidental or deliberate release within the state, and it is also deployable around the world to assist other states, territories, and other nations if required. Any questions on any of the force structure? Okay, thank you.
Continue.
All right, now we'll go into Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And I'm going to let Mr. O'Hare speak to that for just a little bit because he's directly up to that every day.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and for the record, Mike O'Hare, Deputy Director. Mission of critical services to protect lives and property from terrorism and all other hazards, as well as to provide rapid recovery from all disasters. 62 of the finest people in the whole wide world with a great mission to help all Alaska communities prepare, respond, and recover, plan, train, and exercise for any disaster that may come upon them. We do that through partnerships with our local, state, and federal agencies, non-governmental organizations, faith-based organizations to help with recovery processes, as well as some very, very unique tactical communications, as you can see, alert and warning systems, the tsunami warning systems that you see in the coastal communities. We help coordinate getting those into the communities as well as going out to the schools and doing outreach and earthquake simulators and family preparedness kits. So a plethora of preparedness, if you will, Mr. Chairman, and proud to introduce the overview. Thank you very much.
Okay, continue.
Sir, next is our Office of Veterans Affairs, as I mentioned, and with 77,000 known veterans in Alaska and 32,000 actually registered with federal VA and receiving benefits, whether it's pension, medical, VOTEC, educational benefits to them and or their families, based on their federal military service, we still have a lot of the mission to accomplish, which is to get those other 44,000 plus online and at least registered, even if at the end of their life and all they get is that federal gravestone. It's something that, of value to them and definitely long-term to their families, and that's one of our key missions, is to get every one of those veterans registered for a potential benefit to them or their families. Slide, please. Measures and results with Veterans Affairs. This is where they've been. Here's what they're after, and this breaks down those core areas: medical care, insurance or indemnity, educational or VOTEC rehab, or compensation and pension. And as you can see from a very tiny office, the federal results of that over time in millions of dollars brought into the state of Alaska in economic activity and earned benefits to those personnel who served our nation since 2008 has grown significantly with just a small handful of personnel.
Representative Edgemond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to get a better sense. You said a moment ago, back the slide that we just passed, that 32,000 of the 72,000 veterans are registered. So I'm not knowing much at all about your department. What comes to mind to me is that probably a great number of the beyond 32,000 that aren't registered probably reside or have some ties to rural Alaska, and maybe you can reinforce that or dispute it. I guess the other thing that comes to my mind is how many of those that aren't registered are homeless. Do you have any sense of?
The homeless numbers that our office has been working with in coordination with other agencies and the federal VA folks, specifically identified as homeless, is less than 1,000 in Alaska. The last number I understood was in approximately the 600 range, sir, through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Edmonds.
Yeah, as a follow-up, so that's a big disparity between who's registered and who's not registered. Maybe you can
quickly explain why that exists.
Registered versus not registered means that individual veteran has taken the time to meet with their veteran service officer, brought their military record forward, their separation or their honorable discharge document, normally a DD-214, a Department of Defense Form 214, saying, I served and I got discharged. And then bringing that to the federal VA system to register their name, their current address, who they are, where they're at, for any potential benefits they may have earned, whether it's in primarily the four categories identified on the chart. All kinds of reasons veterans have not registered. Some of them are embarrassed because they served and they had a bad experience. Some do not feel they earned a VA benefit because they didn't go to war. They were not wounded. All they did was their 2 years of mandatory service during the draft days, and they served as a cook or a truck driver in Georgia or something like that. There's a lot of folks in Alaska who have interesting character traits, and they think that if they go to Alaska and get off the road network, Uncle Sam won't find them. This is real stuff. And, well, when I ask them or our other folks, are you getting a Social Security check? Are you paying your taxes? Yeah, well, Uncle Sam knows where you're at. Why don't you go ahead and sign up for this benefit? Even if you don't think you earned it, your family may have something that's part of this linked to you that they may be worthy of. Oh, and it's one veteran at a time. And it's a bureaucratic process, which also scares a lot of folks off. And they'll go to the VA. You all know about the national headlines, their backlogs and all that. And not terribly long ago, it would take a year just to do an initial registration as a VA participant. Now they've got it down to 90 to 180 days, on depending on where they're at and the different paperwork that may be available. There's many, many reasons that they may not be registered with the VA.
Okay, thank you. That was a good response.
Me being one of those, in fact. Last year, they harassed me into going ahead and signing up for benefits, and it took me about 90 days. But I got my card, my certifications. I took all my stuff in, and so I am one of those numbers that registered now, finally. Yes. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And I think, General Bridges, this is one of the best things that the department does because, again, there's a lot of people that sacrifice and don't think they deserve anything. But please I want to make the point of the record that the more veterans sign up, regardless of how many services they bring in, that helps plus up the scores for the state, which gives better federal resources for clinics, hospitals, staffing.
An amazing increase. And as we briefed last night, I'm going to be off by a couple of tens of millions, bear with me. But basically, the 32,000 that are registered in Alaska are bringing in $660 million of federal dollars because of being registered with the VA. You're going to almost 2.5 times that if we get those other 44,000 or so their VA benefits. So you look at that economic activity to help reduce potential homelessness issues, to help with medical care and provision that's not a burden on other state medical resources and so forth, the numbers are just extraordinary for such a small state. And again, we have demographically the most veterans of any state per capita, and we have the most currently serving in the military per capita in the nation. So Alaska is truly unique when it comes to current military and veterans. And then you put in their families, and their families may have a benefit based on the service member, that prior service. And Mr. O'Hare just gave me a note. A lot of these folks, back to the previous question, Mr. Chair, a lot of the families don't know that somebody served in the military at some time in their life. So, there's multiple reasons folks are not registered, but the benefits to those individuals or families in our state are already huge, but they could be extraordinary if we get them all.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on your education and voc rehab, are you working with the Department of Labor, or are these programs separate of the ones that they're doing for veterans?
It's a combination of the federal, through the chair, it's a combination of both the federal and the state Department of Labor and the Veterans Affairs federal linkage with them. And, in fact, we set our own state office downtown in Anchorage on DeBar, which is in the same building as the state VOTEC office, so that they're in the same building when that veteran comes in. Verdi Bowen and his crew can walk them right upstairs, link with that federal how to pay the bills for the VOTEC rehab, and link them immediately with that capability and that education for work.
So follow-up, sir?
follow up, Representative.
So basically, you're not doing the this piece is not the education folk rehab, but it's connecting the veterans into that, and then they go into whatever programs, actual education programs that may be in the Department of Labor's budget at that point.
Through the chair, yes, ma'am, that's correct. They link up the resources to pay the way, using the federal VA funds to pay for the educational component.
And one other question, and are you also still working with the university? We had counselors that were supposed to be at UAA, UAF, and UAS just for our veterans to make sure that it was a little easier transition to find the classes that they were due.
Through the chair, the University of Alaska system has holistically looked at that, and they've been resourcing that with veterans service officers at the university level to help us with our veteran student population. And I have to compliment the university president and his chancellors for working with our department, with our Veterans Affairs administrator, and the federal VA folks to set that up.
Perfect. I just want to make sure it was still continuing.
All right. Continue, General Bridges.
Thanks, sir. Next slide, number 11, is the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Now, this is not a constitutional or statutory component of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs in Alaska. It's an additional program, as I mentioned. 20 years ago, Congress enacted this because of the national threat of obesity and students falling out of high school, not becoming educated, becoming welfare lifers, and those sort of things. And so they tasked, challenged, and funded through the Department of Defense and directed that the program be run through the National Guards of the states. 36 states have this program and bring youth at risk from failure at the ages of 16 to 18 who are on the edge of falling out of high school, have dropped out of high school, but they're not yet felons or have become an extreme burden. Some are on probation from juvenile activities, but they have to be willing, and it's a volunteer program, to come to a resident military boot camp type environment run on our National Guard encampment at Fort Richardson, and they go through an academic, physical fitness, self-discipline, citizenship, and community service boot camp program to get them back on track in a 5.5 month resident phase with teachers, with counselors, with physical fitness experts, with health and fitness experts to get them a restart at life before they fail completely. We run two courses per year of the resident program. We graduate approximately 270 per year. We aim for 288, but for various reasons, some of them choose not to continue the program. They're not required to be there. It's purely voluntary. There is a 12-month aftercare component where they must maintain monthly contact with an adult mentor. These are all volunteers to ensure that they're still on track to complete traditional high school. They've moved into an educational or VOTEC program. They've joined the military, or they're working full-time or part-time and going to school of some sort. That way, once they're complete with that 12 months, there's a pretty darn good chance that they're going to be productive young adults doing the right things in life with good choices. We're working a grant program right now, which carries over an additional leg to that, with a follow-on VOTEC program for 5 more months, an apprenticeship type of deal with industry, so that they roll right into a civilian company who's got a job for them, and they're already apprenticing into that. And this is a new program for Alaska. It's not yet in place, but we're expecting success with that here in the next few months. This is part of what the follow-on state budget little bit will be. We're requesting the approval to receive the federal funds. There will be no state match required so that we can receive the federal funds to pay for that program, receive that grant money. And we have industry partners already lining up to be part of that with us.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Bridges, I want to say that I've been privileged to be involved with this program, both as a parent and as a mentor and frequent participant at the graduation exercises. It's one of the second best things that you do for the state. It's very cost effective. There's great results. The investment in these young people saves a lifetime of costs and offers a lifetime of benefits to them. And I want to commend Director Roses and his crew and look forward to continuing support from this body to that program.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, it's been a privilege. I've been a mentor for several of the young people in that program myself, just as a volunteer, and seeing their success over time is just an amazing experience for anybody who's involved. We are graduating our next class at the end of this month. I believe it's the 27th or the 28th. And when we turn those diplomas out, we will have graduated over 4,500 young people since our program in Alaska started in 1993. And as you can see with the graph on 12, where our numbers, and it ebbs and flows a little bit with the participants and the graduate rates. And, you know, we do have an active recruiting program for it, but a huge number of these kids, they're self-referrals from their friends and family members who've been through the program before. So the recruiting is a great mix of those who want to be there or their families are supporting and encouraging them to be there. And we're now in almost multi-generational in some families, in fact. Next slide, 13. Sorry, LASIK only goes so far. Our general fund budget, FY 2016. Representation here, we have been, the far right, the box chart that's stacked, we are a tiny sliver of the state budget, and we have the biggest single workforce if you put all the National Guard members in there collectively. So, again, the term is, I think that we've been pretty successful with bang for the buck return on investment of the state of Alaska. In particular, the vast majority of our revenue and operating funds are federal, and the state match to go with that and to take care of exclusively state business is quite small given the entirety of the state budget overall. Alaska Aerospace at the top left there, you'll see that just 3 weeks ago, the governor's office requested that we transfer the GF out of DMVA and work that as a separate activity as the administration and the legislature determines what is going to be the future of Alaska Aerospace. And again, we'll talk about that a little bit more shortly. Our department GF budget overall grew by $4.3 million between FY07 and FY16. The governor's request was an annual average growth of 3.1%, and our total FY16 governor's request GF budget equals $54 per resident worker. Our AMIA fund had a change because we've now gone from, pardon me, Mike, what was that one? IA. Gone straight to GF versus a pass-through. So that raised that bubble. It's the same money, just comes into us a different way. The funding formula through the Department of Education. Excuse me. Slide 14, appropriations with the DMVA itself, general funds only. And there's a better view of the AMIA, the Military Youth Academy fund change, as DOE pass-through versus GF, which it is now. Same money, just a different way of getting it to us. And then the green, big bump was Alaska Aerospace. And along with President Craig Campbell in there, what his program was to the state administration and to the legislature was to go from $10 million to $8 million, $2 million chunks reduction to zero out within the next 2 years. But again, with the administration's request, that's been moved over, and we've turned that money back in. Next slide, please. This is our all funds, and the slight uptick includes $1.3 million federal funds for the Military Youth Academy, the Job Challenge Grant, as I mentioned a bit ago, $250,000 federal funds for the Veterans Highly Rural Transportation Grant that I spoke to a bit earlier with veterans. It's $250,000 a year for 3 years going forward. We just received that grant, so over a three-year period, $750,000, and this is purely a approval to receive those federal funds. No state match is required. And you'll see the big drop-off there on Alaska Aerospace on the GF, as I mentioned a moment ago, the green bar. Next slide, number 16. And this is the description for the total UGF in each of these programs. Alaska Military Youth Academy, $23,700. Increment was approved to partially offset the cost of the new GED testing requirements, which went from a paper-based test to a computer-based format this last January 1st, 2014. Alaska Military Youth Academy has completed a new GED testing center, identified and purchased the preparatory curriculum and software with licenses to transition that testing for the cadets to the computer-based format for the GED.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A brief question here. I want to make sure there was a question raised a couple days ago about alternative places where young Alaskans can go to get GED testing. This is one such place. I just want to clarify for the record, do all students, all cadets get the opportunity to take the GED test?
The GED is an opportunity for all of them. Some of them, that's not their specific goal, but it's available for every cadet as they go through the program. What we really like to get them to is to go either for the high school diploma that's accredited through our program, or to go back to their traditional high school program and complete the traditional high school diploma, although they can do the GED as well, just to have that in their packet and credentials as they go forward.
And how many graduates have gone through this, had this opportunity through the Youth Corps?
With this coming class, we'll have graduated over 4,500 students since 1993.
We have about 15 minutes, and we're getting a lot of questions. Representative Grunberg, if we can make them short, and the answer is short also.
Guttenberg.
Or Guttenberg, excuse me. I'm thinking of Max. Representative Guttenberg.
We have the same haircut, so that. On the GED, you know, it's great if they're going to get it, but we've been told, and I think it was last year, that the military considers GED it doesn't hold it as high as a regular high school exam, and they're reluctant to take people in. So how does that work if they've come through your program? Is it a higher level of earnings for as far as that goes?
Through the chair, there's kind of two components to that. The military, as it's downsizing dramatically right now, automatically increases the standards for membership into the military services. So that means you essentially have to be a perfect human specimen in all primary categories, physical fitness, medical health, academics, i.e. a high school diploma, and moral, ethical, legal, no issues. The GED holders, other than the surge requirement in the early days of Operation Enduring and Iraqi Freedom, they opened the gates to more GED holders for a bit. But now if you don't have a high school diploma, it's very unlikely you're going to enlist in the military of today.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
I'll hold off. Thanks.
Continue, General.
Yes, sir. Slide 16, the pass-through receipts, as I mentioned before, House Bill 180, which changed the funding methodology for AMIA to a direct appropriation rather than a pass-through through the State Department of Education and Early Development. Services are the same, just a different way of getting the money into the program for the students. Slide 17, decreases in the governor's amended 2016 budget. The Interior Veterans Cemetery Operations, $350,000. That's the annual operating cost that we would have upon build and opening for operation of the Veterans Cemetery up at Fairbanks. The federal VA had to reappropriate the monies that was programmed for that, so it's been slipped to the right by 1 year for construction of that cemetery. So without the need for the operating funds for this first year, we've given that back as part of the governor's budget request for reduction. When the cemetery is built, then that will come back as a request for the annual operating costs. Base realignment and closure impact assistance. This is where we use contract agency of senior military retired officials who help us look at the strategic messaging and preparation for potential base realignment and closure issues to help us look at the strategic impact that might have on the state of Alaska from the state perspective. Given that we're not facing a BRAC itself at this moment, we decided we could do without that amount of funds for this coming year, although in future years that may come back if that threat returns to Alaska.
General, wouldn't that have also been used to maybe address and try to offset some of these base realignments that they're doing with just reduction in force? Shouldn't we try to mitigate that with
we're already steps ahead of that, and we're working with the active component and the community leadership of both Fairbanks and Anchorage for the potential threat reduction of one or both of the brigade combat teams in U.S. Army Alaska. We're already actively working that.
And it doesn't take any funds or even part of this to accomplish that?
We're okay with this back for right now, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And real briefly, this is maybe a bit off point, but I want to make sure all the members of the committee know there will be listening sessions in Anchorage and Fairbanks in about 2 weeks, and I encourage us all to speak up and make sure to clearly express we need to avoid any reductions in active duty forces in Alaska. That it applies to both Jay Barrett and the South Central and all the interior bases as well.
And our new leadership for our department will be participating in those, and we've been coordinating and doing that work already with all kinds of agencies and partners. Army Guard facilities maintenance, we've been benefited greatly from some other states not spending their facilities money the last 3 years. So we received nearly $50 million of additional federal money to build, maintain, modernize some of our Army Guard facilities. Given the request by the governor and the state's budget conditions, rather than going into where we were in some nice-to-dos going forward, we turned a couple of small of the projects off this coming year. No harm to us. It was, I say we were getting into the nice-to-dos versus have-to-dos. So just a small slice there. And then the $133,000 general fund match against the pre-disaster mitigation activities. Basically, that's the preparatory training outreach for communities in their own local emergency planning processes. So instead of putting people out and spending a lot of travel money and some things like that, we're going to go to more video or teleconference training, mail out and push packages to help some of those communities continue to refine their own emergency response plans. And when we do our twice a year consolidated training and exercise, we're going to modify and expand our training packages and information and awareness programs when folks come into Anchorage for those consolidated conferences. So $133,000, no foul, won't lose any people. We're just going to be a bit more creative on how we deliver some of that training and messaging. Next slide, please. And I'm nearly done with the slide deck, by the way. Slide 18, Alaska Military Youth Academy. This is the increase of the federal authority to come to our state, as I mentioned a couple of times before, and that's for the 40-month grant for the job training component for select cadets who want to do the VOTEC transition program right into civilian work. And then the $250,000 for the Office of Veterans Affairs, that's the first year of the very rural veterans ground in Alaska ferry system travel to get to VA care and programs. So no state match required. We just need the authority to receive the federal funds for both of these. Slide, please. All right. Now we're going to come to exclusively Alaska Aerospace, and that will be the concluding portion of our presentation, Mr. Chairman. Have we got Alaska Aerospace Vice President on the phone?
Mr. Grebe, are you on the phone?
Yes, this is Mark Grebe, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Alaska Aerospace. Thank you to the Chair for recognizing us, and thank you, General Bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Grebe. We do have the overview pages here. We've got two of them, it looks like, so if you want to go ahead.
I believe there's three pages. We can see you on the gavel-to-gavel on screen, too. So on the introductory page, I think many of you have seen this before. We were created in 91 as a public corporation, and we are now within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We are, by charter and legislation, an independent corporation with a board of directors that's appointed by the governor. And our mission is to develop aerospace-related economic growth within the state of Alaska. And by aerospace, this is other than the airplanes, airports, airlines type things. We do the other things. Slight correction to here, we employ approximately 35 personnel, not the 50 personnel stated on this particular slide. And right now, we are still the newest launch facility, and we are FAA licensed to do commercial launches, DoD launches, essentially any launch. And why we exist is we have that great access to the southern sky. We have the largest launch range of anywhere in the United States. Any questions?
I don't see any so far.
Next slide. Next slide, then, please. So in FY 2015, we had changes throughout the year over our ask, which was last year was approximately $6 million for the general fund. During FY 2015, we did receive and execute a launch contract. And I know there's a lot of news, but I will categorically state that the launch went fine, our customer's flight not so much, but the launch was fine, and that was their release in their study. We do have a global imaging services contract selling satellite-produced products. We are the sole distributor for Alaska Data. We did a $2 million reduction in general funds from the year before, just as we said we would, and it was also in our ask this year, but we understand where the governor is at, and we are reducing, taking the reduction even further. We've deleted vacant PCNs to do that, and this is all FY 2015, and we are using and plan to use the deferred maintenance money that we received in 2015. For the FY 2016, next slide, please. FY 2016, we are completed our rebuild of our damaged facilities. Deconstruction is going on right now. We are using insurance funds only for this, and so it's not out of the general fund or the state's coffers in any form. It is out of the insurance. We are rebuilding to the pre-mission condition that we were at. We are not doing any additional work. We are working to secure an additional launch contract. We are on contract to do this with another launch, but that has not necessarily been funded yet. But that's why our push to get the launch done. We were in our original contract, we were under contract to be able to launch again within 12 months. We're in the process of getting federal operations and sustainment funding. The original request was for $10 million in committee, got moved to $7 million, and then in actual enactment down to $6 million split between all orbital launch sites that use or that support DoD launches. And there's only two of us, which is us and Wallops. So nominally, that's a $3 million to us. However, we don't have that yet actually in our checkbook, and it's going through its federal funding to us loops. We expect it to actually be something less than $3 million by the time it gets into our pockets. We will be initiating the imaging data satellite downlink services. Right now, we receive our data from our imaging company, but we will be downloading and downlinking data from the satellites during this period. We are reaching out to a much larger market in the launch services. We are eliminating our state funding for operations and sustainment and our deferred maintenance out of our budget for FY 2016. And we are positioning ourselves to be completely independent of any state funding needs.
Representative Guerra has a question, Mr. Grebe.
Only after he's done with this presentation, Mr. Grebe.
Mr. Grebe, are we at the end of your slides, it looks like?
Yes, we are.
Okay, Representative Guerra, we're there.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. My first question is on page 20 on the new launch contract. That new launch contract, that was just that one launch that occurred earlier or last year, right? There's no remaining launches that will come under that contract. Is that correct?
Our contract was for a launch and to be ready for a launch in 12 months.
The one to be ready for a launch, do you have a commitment for that launch, or is that not committed?
We have a commitment for the launch. The launch is not funded at this time by the federal government. They're going through their budget loops right now, too, just like you are.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, through the chair. On page 21, you mentioned securing an additional launch contract. That's not a contract that's been secured. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then just finally, on the new global imaging services contract, is that something that is generating money for the Aerospace Corporation, or is that infrastructure that you're building in hopes of generating money in the future?
Page 20, through the chair to Representative Guerra, just clarification, the initiate imaging data satellite downlink services line is what you're asking about, sir.
I was looking at page 20 where it said new global imaging services contract, and I was wondering whether that's something that's...
Page 20, excuse me, thank you, through the chair to Representative Guerra, through the chair, that is... There is no infrastructure associated with that. This is a pure revenue generator for us.
And then finally,
we have another follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. So, just so I understand, what is the cost to you for that contract, and what is the revenue that's being generated by it?
I'm looking through. I don't have that right here, but I will be happy to get that those numbers to you and the rest of the committee.
Mr. Grebe, I understand that next week Mr. Campbell and or yourself will be here, and you're going to have a couple of presentations for us, so I imagine at that time we'll have a business plan and what your numbers are. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, we can do that. Craig Campbell will be meeting with the governor's office next week
and
over this. So.
With myself also.
And okay. You.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. Grebe, we often talk in this committee about the need to encourage economic diversification in the state. We're speaking right now of the strictly state budget, but can you speak a little bit about the economic ripple effects of having a medium launch facility operant in Alaska? What would it mean to have a medium launch capacity? How would it ripple through the university, through other private businesses?
To Representative Sadler, through the chair, the medium lift is where the bulk of the new satellite launches are going to be out of the market for the next several years. If you will, the small satellite market of what we are designed to do, this was a venture in some ways ahead of its time because the satellites are still larger than that. So the medium lift positions us to go to newer constellations of satellites that have to go into polar, high inclination types of orbits, sun synchronous orbits, that are only reachable out of a U.S. launch site from Kodiak and Vandenberg. Vandenberg is extremely crowded right now and backlogged, and you're at the mercy of others. So we want to make sure we are positioned into medium lift to be able to take advantage of that market. But as you know right now, per the governor's order, we have stopped all forward progress on moving into medium lift.
Okay, Representative Skowzowski, do you have a question also?
Just a clarification.
We have about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Grebe. Just a real quick clarification to Representative Guerra's question on the securing an additional launch contract in FY16. That is a that is in addition to the multi-year, multi-contract launch that you secured from the previous for the previous launch. Get that?
Yes, sir. To Representative Kawasaki via the chairs. Yes, sir. That is in addition to the multi-year contract that we were referring to on the previous page.
But he also stated that the governor has put everything on hold, so they are not moving forward at this time. Is that correct, Mr. Grebe?
We are not moving forward on medium lift. We are moving forward on our current launch capabilities on our current launch site, configured the way it is now.
Okay. Is there any further questions? We are down to the 3:30 hour. President Bridges, Mr. Dole, Mr. O'Hare, and Mr. Grebe, I thank you very much for your presentations. Appreciate you being here today, and it looks like we'll be dealing with you a little bit more next week. Okay, at this time, next Monday, February 9th at 1:30 p.m., we will be having a continuing overview from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and also overview from the Department of Corrections. And at 3:30 p.m., I adjourn this meeting.